What is up, my metal maniacs? This is the Judas Priest cast.
And we've got another episode coming.
And you've got another awesome guest coming. We have today with us Scott Haskin, a fellow podcaster in the Deep Dive Podcast Network. He's the mastermind of the Magicians podcast dedicated to Uriah Heep. You're listening to a show right now where we plan to eventually talk about every Judas Priest song, but Scott has already done that for a different British band named Uriah Heep. Scott has discussed their entire catalog, which, by the way, is massive. Uriah Heep has 25 albums. They're a hardworking and long-running band who formed in 1969, the same year as Judas Priest, for those of you keeping score. Heap never achieved the same level of fame that Priest did, but I think they're a band who Priest fans would like. So I'm glad that we have Scott here to tell us more. What's up, Scott?
What's going on, George and Hattie? Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, yeah. We're really glad to have you here.
Yeah, Scott, it's a pleasure. You know, we've talked and we've known each other for quite a while, and we're buddies in the same Deep Dive network, and it's great that we can finally get you on board for your first appearance here.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I've talked enough about Uriah Heep, I think, almost 400 episodes to get that show complete. There are episodes still airing through early June that are coming out 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And on Wednesdays, I have the podcast that I do with Corey and John, Backtracks. Wow, I can't think today. Backtracks Aerosmith Revisited, where we're going through all of the Aerosmith catalog now. And as I wind down the Uriah Heep show, gives me just a different band to have a perspective on.
That's
really
a lot.
Cool. Yeah. So finish with one band, jump right into a podcast about another band, Scott.
Absolutely. And then I'm still doing the Haskin Cast podcast, which I've been doing for, I think, 5.5 years now. That also comes out on Wednesdays. That's just about, I'll do an album review or a movie or a show review. Sometimes I'll have someone in the entertainment industry as a guest. I've interviewed some really cool people. And it's just kind of like a entertainment variety. You never know what you're going to get from week to week.
Yeah.
That's exciting,
but
it's the same.
It's the same quality content from the same Scott Haskin who you know and love, no matter which show you're listening to. And I know that you get around onto other people's shows as well. I've heard you as a guest on Metallicast talking about Ride the Lightning. I know you've been on And the Podcast Will Rock, all about Van Halen. You've been on that quite a few times now, as mm-hmm. have I. And Hattie, I think you were on that once.
Yeah, on the Christmas
probably,
episode.
Yeah. And then probably will be again in the future, but that's for the future. But hey, mm-hmm. the point is we all know each other and we're all running in the same circles. So Scott is here to lend his expertise as a musician since age 6, I think you said before we got on the call. That's yeah.
6 is when I got into it. 7 is when I really started taking it a little bit seriously.
You play the drums now, I know. Did you start with drums or something else?
I started with guitar at 6, and I just found that I didn't get along with stringed instruments very well. And I switched to drums at age 7 and I've been a drummer ever since. I picked up the bass a few years ago, and I love playing bass. I feel like I'm forever going to be a novice at it, but it's something I really enjoy. So it's good to have as a musician. Good to be able to approach music from different angles. I also play keyboard. Most of the stuff I write is on keyboard. So I find that depending on where I'm approaching a song from, my perspective on that song is completely different. So it's a lot of fun to be a little bit versatile.
Yeah, it sounds very cool. So I have a very brief music history. I started at 5 taking vocal lessons, and I gave up by the age of 8.
Wow. What made you stop?
Well, it was boring. Like where I was like taking the lessons, it was my old kindergarten, and it really didn't suit me. And I was like putting most of my focus on art, like as an after school activity, so it didn't work.
Yeah, it's really something that you have to be passionate about. I think mm-hmm. you can do it to some level, but why bother if it's not making you happy? If anything doesn't make you happy, why are we doing it?
Exactly. Like the way I was being taught back then, like it was really in a different way. Like they were not giving us like a lot of technicalities or things that might interest me. So I kind of like not like that as much as I would have. So it never stuck with me since then.
Understandable. Mm-hmm. Very understandable. Well, I'm glad you gave it a shot though.
Yeah. Well, I'm South Asian. I don't have to give it a shot. I will be taken there by parents.
There you go.
God, man. I think that you got to tell us a little bit about Uriah Heep because I feel like some of our listeners may not know or may not even have heard of Uriah Heep. They're a band really worthy of taking a look into. Why don't you just give us the basic lowdown?
Sure. You know, it's really interesting. I hear that from so many people, especially in America, where they'll be like, "Oh, Uriah Heep, yeah. What was their song?" As if they only had one. I mean, 53 years, 25 albums. You know, they've had more than one. But most people, I think they would know them if they heard them because Easy Livin' was a very popular song. A lot of times, people go, "Oh, yeah," and they don't make that connection that was Uriah Heep. But there's July Morning, Lady in Black, Gypsy, so many songs that people actually do know. But for some reason, while Uriah Heep is really considered the fourth grandfather of hard rock music, because you had, of course, Zeppelin, Sabbath, and Purple, and then people say the fourth was Uriah Heep, but they never gained that same notoriety. And I think because it was in the U.S. that didn't happen. Whereas Zeppelin, Purple, and Sabbath hit really heavy in the U.S.
They took off.
Yeah, they're very popular in Europe. I mean, they're headlining huge festivals. You know, Wacken Open Air is probably the biggest festival, and they headline that. So they're certainly not an unknown band. I just think there's something about America, but it's weird when I've seen them live here, that house is packed, people are screaming. It's pretty amazing. In fact, I saw them open for Judas Priest. That's the one time I saw Priest was back in June 29th of 2019. It was the last show I saw before COVID, I think. And, no, I saw Purple right before COVID. Heap opened, and I stuck around for about half a Priest set, and I thought they were fantastic. I mean, I didn't know them, so I didn't go there to see them, but Rob Halford, man, he is a presence on stage. He commands attention like Alice Cooper does. And that is really something because Alice Cooper, if you've ever seen him perform live, he is a puppet master. You really feel like he's controlling everybody on stage and everyone in the crowd, including you.
I saw him in 2022. And exactly as you say, man, like you could just tell he's so experienced that every single movement he made was calculated down to the inch. Like he knew exactly what was happening on the stage and exactly how he wanted to make the crowd react. Mm-hmm. He's like on another level.
And I honestly think I saw him on the ultimate night because I grew up in Detroit where he's from. And he played at Joe Louis Arena, where the Red Wings used to play. So big, you know, hockey stadium. Halloween night, 1988. And Kane Roberts was playing guitar. I believe Kip Winger was bass at that time. And Halloween, he pulled out all the stops. I mean, it was like a full 2-hour show. He hung himself. He cut his head off. He did the most amazing thing where he threw all these boxes on top of each other and the boxes got up and walked around. And I still haven't figured that out because he didn't gently place them. He like tossed them, which is just amazing. But this isn't an Alice Cooper show. It's not even a Uriah Heep show. But when I saw Rob Halford, it gave me that same feeling that all eyes here, buddy. You know, I am here on stage. You're here for me. Even though it's not his own band, he really commanded that attention. And it just immediately drew me back to that Alice Cooper moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like Cooper, Halford is also one of those special kind of frontmen. And yeah.
Charismatic. Yeah. Very charismatic, I guess.
Right. Right. I've seen Priest a few times and they definitely have that. Hattie, like, I'm sure that with it, all the concerts you've seen on YouTube, you've noticed the same thing. Like your eyes are definitely on that. Yeah, your eyes are in front, just like Scott said.
Well, and this was not the first time I saw him, actually. Years ago, so this would be back in November 30th of 93. Oh, so just before Halloween, he played a show with his band Fight at the Ogden Theater in Denver. And I was living in Denver at the time. My buddy was in a band. I'm pretty sure that band was The Dark, who had been on Star Search, that show with Ed McMahon, and they were opening for Fight. And if I've calculated right, that was Fight's 16th gig. So they were pretty new and unknown. And that was the first time I saw Rob Halford. And it was kind of that same thing. It was that, is there anyone else on stage with this guy? Because all our eyes are on him. You know, he's got the Hellraiser trench coat. He's got that just serious, you're going to look at me and you're going to hear what I got to say. And that's all there is to it, attitude. And the funny thing is, like, whenever I've heard him interviewed, he's such a gentle character, right?
He really is.
But on stage, he just turns into somebody else.
He commands all of your senses, like not just eyes and ears. You will like want to feel that person's presence with like everything. Like even when we are watching on like the screens.
Right. Yeah, so
he's got the theatrical performance background, like just down pat. Like reading his biography, I was interested to learn one of his very first jobs as a teen was working at a theater and doing lighting and maintenance and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, growing up around the environment, you learn a lot of things. And you learn things like stage presence. And if you're paying attention, you can do really well. That hopefully explains Uriah Heep. I don't think I really did.
Yeah, I mean, something that I agreed with is when you hear the songs, you might just say, oh, yeah, I know that. When I was listening to their first two albums after we had first met and I asked you, what should I check out? And there are like at least a few songs on those first two Uriah Heep albums where I was saying, I swear to God, I've heard that on the radio before on classic rock, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know how diverse Priest's catalog is. I would imagine they're pretty much heavy rock the whole way. Uriah Heep has gone through a lot of different phases. I mean, they worked with an orchestra on Salisbury. They brought in, all kinds of different tricks and things. They've gone through the 80s phases. They sounded very different in the 80s. They're an incredibly heavy band now. They went through mystical phases where their albums were almost concept albums that weren't quite a concept album, like The Magician's Birthday. So they've changed their sound so many times over the years. It's hard to say when somebody says, what should I listen to? I don't know, because I if you listen to the whole catalog, you'll probably find a bunch of stuff that you'll like somewhere in there, if not all of it. So it's really hard to pick for people. So I usually say, well, if you like something heavy, try their current stuff. If you like something a little more progressive, try their older stuff. Although their current stuff is pretty progressive too. It's really hard to pinpoint a band like this because their catalog is so all over the place.
Right. Although it is worth pointing out that like Priest, Heep is very much an active band and they just released a new album this year in 2023. And it was really good too.
Oh yeah, I'm glad you liked it. It's a very heavy, very much like their last album, Live in the Dream, their new album, Chaos and Color. It feels to me like it was a bunch of musicians that were just penned up going, I've got to do something, and just exploded in songwriting. What's really fun about this album is that the drummer, Russell Gilbrook, when I interviewed him, when I first started the Heap show, he was actually the second person from the current band that I interviewed, because I interviewed Mick Box, the band leader, first. He's the only one that's been there since the beginning. And when I interviewed Russell, he said he was working on some songs with his friend Simon Pinto. Four or so of those songs are now on the new album. And it was really cool to see his excitement for those songs when I interviewed him, and then the fruition of you know, them actually making it to the final album was really cool. And then the bass player wrote a song with someone else, Jeff Scott Soto, who worked with Yngwie Malmsteen and all kinds of people. And they have a song in the album together. So it's, the band is very open to what's the best thing for this album, instead of, okay, yeah, you wrote a song with somebody else, that's great. Okay, let's get back to us. You know, they're very open to just making a great album. And they did here.
And collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
really
cool. Really
cool.
Yeah. I all the guys, I've interviewed all of the guys in the current band, and they're all very cool, very nice people. I've enjoyed talking to each one of them. We keep talking about, hopefully they're going to get over here to America and we can meet up and that in person. The first time I saw them was actually the first time they had played in Vegas in like 30 years. And
that's cool.
I decided to go out to dinner before the show, and I walk in and I see them sitting at a table at the same restaurant. And I'm like, should I just say hi? Like, they're just having a meal before their show. Like, I don't want to be some other guy that comes up and bothers them. You know, so I regretted not going over there and saying hi, because like, what are the chances I'm ever going to get to talk to these guys again? And then I saw that they were having their 50th anniversary. They were doing a big special thing. And this was right before COVID. And so when that wasn't going to happen and they were going to have to put that on hold, I tried to reach out to figure out who Mick's manager was, see who I could, you know, how I could get through to get an interview. And I couldn't figure it out. But Mick was doing a YouTube series at the time called Ask Mick, where you could write in a question and he would do a YouTube video answering the question.
Nice.
5 minutes, I swear, 5 minutes after I sent my question, I found his manager's info. And I'm like, oh, crap. Now I'm going to look like a dork, you know? So I reached out to his manager. His manager got back to me the next day and said, if you can be on at like noon England time, I can get you on with Mick. And I'm like, of course, you know? So he sends me
over.
Which
is, of course, super duper early in the morning for you.
4 a.m.
That was calculating. It might be very odd time.
Yeah. But you know what? I didn't care, because I'm going to get on the phone with Mick Box, this guy I've been listening to since I was a kid, right? So I couldn't sleep. I think I slept an hour in my chair, and I was afraid that I would miss the time, because like dealing with international calling and, you know, the time zones and everything, I'm like, I'm going to screw this up. So I just ended up not being able to sleep, had a great conversation with Mick. And at the end, I said, I don't know if you've heard of these deep dive podcasts. The Deep Dive Podcast Network was very small at the time, I think like 5 or 6 shows. And I said, you know, I explained how it worked. I said, I'd love to do one on Uriah Heep. And he just paused and he went, sounds great. Let's do it. And that was it.
What a guy. Yeah. Yes. And that's also cool to note. Your show is officially blessed or endorsed by the band themselves.
It is. Yeah. He actually sent me, he had his graphic artist do a little endorsed by Uriah Heep version of their logo for me to put on the show promotional pick. And so that little logo goes on everything that that involves the show, which is really cool because I don't know of any other band podcast that's endorsed.
So far, I guess it's not, like, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the most part, these are all just sort of fan-made, and mm-hmm. you've got a teeny little bit of extra credibility there, Scott, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah, thanks. I've tried it with a couple other bands and I've gotten just deaf ears, but you know, who knows? Maybe I'll do another band podcast some way, but for me, it has to be like band approved. Mm-hmm. And that's just a thing with me. If I'm going to play the music, I just feel like I should do that. It's totally acceptable not to, and I get that. But for me, that's just a little thing. So any of those bands that I can't get that I would want to do, I'm just reviewing those albums as a whole on the Haskincast podcast, but I'm not doing that deep dive where I'm, you know, going into every little bit of the song and dissecting it.
But we will be doing that today.
Cool. Yes, we will.
Yes. So Scott, I know that you are the most casual and basic of Judas Priest fans. But of course, we invited you on the show because you're our friend and we value your musical expertise. And we know we can count on you to pretty much jump in and give us a good comment on any song. That said, I do like to try and match the song with the guest and give them a pairing that I think fits. And I think that today's song is going to be a good fit for you. It's from the first Judas Priest album in 1974. And this is a time when I would say they were most alike, most similar. They were contemporaries with Uriah Heep. And we have a strange experimental song from the second side of the debut album, Rockarola, Dying to Meet You, Hero Hero.
So are these two songs merged together into one?
Yeah, I would say some versions,
those are, yeah.
Okay. So if you get, like, if you buy the physical CD, are they two separate tracks or are they one track together?
I would say most of the versions have it as one track.
Okay.
And there are some versions that did have them separated, and that makes it a little confusing. I would say in that sense, it's similar to the first Black Sabbath album where you have like that whole Wasp basically behind the wall of sleep thing that mm-hmm. And some versions of the albums separated them out and some of them combined it into just massive 10-minute tracks. Anyway. Yeah,
and they did that same thing on Born Again and on Mob Rules too, where they had those songs that just kind of flow from one into another. And the challenge becomes if you buy the album digitally, right? And you're using like, let's say iTunes or something like that. If it's separated, you get a stop between the two tracks because iTunes puts in that 2-second pause. And it reminds me, it actually makes me feel like we're going back to the old 8-track days where you would just be listening to a song all happily and then it would just stop and you would hear a click and then it would start up again. And it's the most annoying way to listen to music because it just takes you right jarring. Out of the song.
Yeah, it is jarring. Hattie, could you imagine just listening to The Hellion and then you're getting into it and all of a sudden it stops and goes click, and then you have to wait a couple seconds before Electric Eye starts.
Well,
it's not as engaging.
We just don't want to like imagine that. So there we are.
You guys can't see it, but poor Hattie has the most defeated look on her face, imagining how horrible that would actually be.
Yes,
well,
I
did grow up in that era where we used to listen to cassette tapes. So I kind of have that experience, but you know, like, thankfully, we didn't have to, like, relive that, like, for at least the last 2 decades.
Yeah, the worst part about cassettes was if you were listening to the side that was shorter, you had the end of the last song, and then you had all the silence because there was just nothing there. Because the other side
was
longer.
The tape has to still roll to the end, right?
Right. Yeah. Or trying to find where your song starts.
Yep.
You know, apart from that, cassettes were. I loved cassettes because you could take them anywhere. You could just pop them in the car, listen to your favorite songs. I loved vinyl, but it did have that limitation of you had to just put it on cassette if you wanted to, you know, go cruising around and listen to your songs.
Yeah, and cassettes were like comparatively cheaper. And I'm guilty of like destroying my dad's whole cassette tape collection of classical music when I was a kid, as a part of like curious take on my possibly my first engineering endeavors. So there we have it.
Engineering the cassette tapes by putting a pencil inside and taking the tape out.
Hey, the struggle was real.
That nice things. Like I was like smashing those and getting the tapes out. Like was I don't remember what exactly I was doing. I tried to dissect the whole thing.
You know, they had screws, right? You could just unscrew them.
Well, I wasn't allowed a screwdriver. Like I was too young for that.
Oh, wow. But they gave you a hammer?
No, they didn't. Like, I would have to find something, like, even, like, chair legs or whatever I could, like, pull up and smash it.
Oh, my God. I like you even more.
All right. You getting curious to hear this song, Scott?
I'm dying to hear Dying to Meet You.
Here we go. Off to an interesting start already, and this is a song that has a lot of peaks and valleys in it because it starts off with a pretty heavy rock riff, but then once the verse comes in, it slows down and it mellows out to something a little more emotional, maybe a little more sensitive, and then once that verse is over, then you go right back into that heavy riff, which is one of those classic hallmarks of early Priest when they would do these sort of epic songs that were lengthier.
Yeah, that's a lot to take in.
Like everything, the music and lyrically, it is a lot.
These lyrics, they go pretty deep, I would say.
Very.
Addie, I know you love this song, so I'm going to let you kick it off for us.
Well, first off, like when I first heard this song, it kind of gave like that concentration camp kind of vibe, like how it would happen, like these slaughters and how people were taken there, like placed on lines and things happen. And also, like as I have told George, like I have sort of personal connection to this song. And it kind of starts from the beginning, like I came in this morning high on the bird's wing, like the first four or five lines. As I was saying, so we had this mutiny in a military area in our city where I went to school in, like I was a recent graduate in 2008.
This event has its own Wikipedia page, Bangladesh Rifles Revolt.
Yeah, our school was called Rifle School. So yeah, I went there and I finished in 2008. So this mutiny happened in 2009 and I went there, like it happened in February 2009 and I went there in April 2009 to get my certificates and all. And the moment I got in that area, which was like very prim and that way military areas generally are, but it was a complete disaster. And as they say, like people with no smile, stern-faced people who were leading you to places, like it was like that kind of place. So when I stepped in, it was a disarray and only like guard dogs running everywhere and like very stern military officers were guiding people to places in very abrasive way, which was needed as protocol. And it was so heartbreaking because like this place, even though military places are sterile and all, but it was home, like for me from 95 to 2008. So yeah, it was so emotional and so scary that when the moment I got in, these verses were just playing in my head and like I was in a very emotional state is all I can say. And that experience is still vivid in my brain. I went back there for reunion and everything, but every single time now I get there, it feels eerie and different because of that incident and all.
Wow, I can't even imagine just waking up every day and looking out your window and seeing that. And it had to be really frightening and depressing. And it had to have had a difficult effect on you to even just be able to concentrate on study.
Well, I graduated then, but yeah, like I started vet school in another city, but then I came back after that tragedy because like I had other reasons to leave vet school, but yeah, I was so shook and I was just a teenager ending high school and starting college. So things were very different for me. And like, I have a few military connections, so we were collectively a little shaken. And it was like not an easy thing to process for anyone.
Yeah. You know, I remember years ago seeing a video of this elderly lady slowly walking down the street carrying a bag of groceries, and a bomb went off just a few hundred feet from her, and she didn't even flinch. And I thought, what kind of conditioning does it take to not have a sense of, I need to get shelter, I need to get in the opposite direction from this, I need to protect myself, like to just not even notice it? I mean, that just, it boggles my mind, the conditioning that people go through when they are in those kind of places.
Yeah, it totally does. It kind of happened several times again when there were terrorist attacks or things in the city. It would like get really scary for me to take public transport and all that. So I went through that phase again and again later in my life. But that was possibly the first one. And it's still like the scariest so far.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm sorry that you had to go through that. That's pretty awful. So is the song about the concentration camps in Germany? Is that what I'm gathering?
Yeah, what I'm seeing in these lyrics is they're surveying the landscape post-war or post-battle. Definitely feels like the aftermath of battle in here to me. And that'll become probably more apparent as we get into the second verse. There's one line in here that I picked out that I really like. Fourth line says, picking out landmarks that said I was there. And right now I'm picturing bombed out buildings or destroyed statues, any sort of damage from the battle that's wreckage.
My mind goes a little bit darker. I actually was thinking bodies, like maybe people that he had to put down for whatever reason. I'd probably just seen way too many movies,
but it could be that too.
Yeah, it immediately went to that. It's such a delicate subject, and because it invokes, whether somebody's directly been involved with it or had, you know, most of us have relatives or friends of, you know, friends or whatever that have been involved. So we have some kind of connection, but just even as human beings, there's that, how can you just hurt people you don't even know, you know, over whatever the argument is.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it could be another point of view, like, you know, someone who is in the ranks of these bad people who are doing these all atrocities, but they don't feel the same way, and they don't really agree with the that kind of mindset. So yeah. Inside they're like having this passive aggressive thought that you are awful people and whatever you are doing is bad. And, you know, they are narrating this whole thing from their perspective, like how things are happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we talk about the sound of the band a little bit?
Yes, please.
Definitely has a very late 60s feel to it, to early 70s. As I'm listening to the drums, they're very dry. You know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of reverb. They don't seem very alive, but it has that playing style of like, you know, early Black Sabbath or King Crimson, or, you know, with those longer drum rolls. It's really fascinating to me because I didn't know what to expect, especially knowing this was an older song. But when I think Judas Priest, I think, you know, that really heavy, crunchy guitar sound. And I'm like, okay, this is barely even distorted. This was really unexpected. What I loved most about it, though, was how this really showcases what a great singer Rob Halford really is. Because he's sustaining notes for a long period of time. He's got a great vibrato. He's singing very smoothly and clearly. I mean, this isn't just a guy fronting a hard rock band. This is a guy who knows how to sing and knows how to perform.
That's very well said.
Mm-hmm. He was young back then, like in his early to mid-20s, right?
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were a very young band at one point. We think of Judas Priest as an old band because we see them now, but these elderly geezers in Judas Priest, at some point, they were young men, and had huge chips on their shoulders, and they were broke and raw and hungry and still figuring out exactly what kind of role they wanted to carve out in the world of rock and what would eventually become known as metal.
Mm-hmm. But I would say their style and sound is very much of the time. They don't seem like they're like, you know, who are these guys? Where are they coming from? Where did they record? Everything seems very much a part of that era, you know, stylistically, sound-wise, everything.
I would agree.
Yeah, it sounds very 70s.
Yeah, very, yeah, steeped in that hard rock and blues rock of the era. There are little hints of what would eventually become metal, but they certainly were not fully there yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is their first album. So they're just, you know, even if they've been together for a while as an unsigned band, I mean, once you're signed, that's everything changes. You're really just kind of getting started at that point. So I think there's probably going to be a little, what's going to be acceptable? How are we going to, you know, if we go too crazy, we're going to get ignored. We're not going to get gigs. So you have to conform to a certain extent. I'd be curious to hear what they were doing before this album, like what kind of jams they had and what their sound was before this, and see how much the industry changed or directed them on how to be.
Well, rock and roll kind of went through a lot of changes. First off, like Priest didn't sign with Halford, like they had a different vocalist, Alan Atkins. So he couldn't complete the album or like sing in this because he had to go and raise his child, and Halford replaced him. And so they did this, and they were a very young band, and the label had all the says. So they really did whatever they liked. And I guess the band had to comply with the label, with the kind of sound it's going to be and everything. And they also did a lot of cutting and pasting or whatever they did.
Yeah, right. It's really whoever the record company assigns as a producer that puts the shape on the cake.
Yeah, that's 100% right. Scott, you made a good call earlier when you said that there was a sound resembling of Black Sabbath. The producer on Rockarola is Roger Bain, and Roger Bain is well known for doing the first few Sabbath records.
There you go. Yeah, the drum sounds very, very same, that really dry, you know, like I said, late 60s, early 70s. If you want a good comparison, listen to the song In the Court of the Crimson King or Epitaph from the album In the Court of the Crimson King, and you'll very much hear a similar drum recording to that, that same dry, the snare doesn't have a lot of snap to it. You're hearing mostly the vibrations of the strings as opposed to the stick hit. I love the sound, though. Don't get me wrong. It's very nostalgic. It's very of the time, but I've always loved that sound.
Yeah, it is nice. You can identify it very much with the era.
Mm-hmm.
And that being said, I think we should listen to more. But I'm going to rewind 10 seconds because I want to hear again how Rob Halford really sustains and draws out the last note when he sings the word face. And he holds that note.
Amazing.
Listeners, I know I told you to listen to how Rob sustains that last word in verse number one. He does a pretty good job of it in verse number two as well. And even from this very young age, he's showing off the natural talent that he always had, the sort of singing talent that made him get noticed by the band in the first place and chosen as the replacement for Alan Atkins, like Hattie was saying before. But hey, little did they know that he would go on to be the face and the voice of the band for decades to come.
And a bloody metal god.
The metal god. Mm-hmm. What are we getting out of these lyrics now that we're into the second verse? So I'm definitely feeling like, again, more of a war and a battle theme in here. It says as much right at the end in the last line of this verse as into the battle we are all led. So now you kind of get that confirmation that is what they're talking about. And you're getting some pretty vivid imagery here. One line says, every few moments I watch a friend die and a selfishness breeds in this cesspool of sorrow. Well, hey, I mean, you can't really misinterpret that. You know, whoever's the narrator in this, they're in a dark place.
Yeah, like there is nothing like light or, you know, positive in the whole place so far. So yes, like, you know, now that I think of it, like I always have had it thinking in a different way, like Holocaust and all that. But it can also be interpreted in other ways, like this a battlefield where like in previous times when battles would actually start and stop instead of how guerrilla warfare work now. So when an arm raises, people start fighting in the battlefield, like with guns or swords and anything, and they would just start slaughtering, and some people would like to dock and like flee from the battlefield or hide behind other people to save themselves, things like that. So yeah, and it is common to like, you know, see your friends or people you really cared about not make it. So yeah, it kind of makes sense. And now it makes me think of World War One. I can't get enough of war reference, yes.
I think these are general enough that the lyrics could basically apply to any war or battle you want to make them fit to.
Yeah.
I think at the very least, there might be a plane reference, so it's somewhat modern. The very first line of the song came in this morning high on a bird's wing. So I interpret that as getting helicoptered into a battle.
How did I not think of that? Wow. Yeah, it could definitely be. Like, it would also be Vietnam, you know, like in 70s.
It would have been so timely.
It was like happening back then. And, you know, West even had a very different opinion of difference about Vietnam, because now we know what it was like. But back then, it really, I don't have words right now. So, yeah, it was questionable, to say the least.
Certainly. So musically, the song is continuing on in the same vein.
Mm-hmm.
I like in the verses, the guitar parts. Does that sort of remind you of the more groovy, jammy sections of maybe something like Zeppelin or a rock song from this era, Scott?
Yeah, I think so. I like that it's mellow musically. They're really just kind of caving or carving the space for the vocals and the lyrics to come through. But it has a dark, sad tone to it, even though it isn't necessarily like dark playing, but it just has that feel. And the sound with the combination of the lyrics really just has like an overtone to it of, we're not in a good place right now. We're not okay. You know, this, it doesn't like, I think people tend to think this kind of music needs to be aggressive. You're talking about war and battles and murder, and you know, you really need to push it like maybe Metallica would with something like Disposable Heroes. But I think it's more emotional. You feel more of a connection when you're telling the story this way, because you're envisioning just seeing people that you know just getting blown to bits right next to you. And I think about the first time I saw the movie Saving Private Ryan. And I had read that was from soldiers that were actually there, the most realistic portrayal of what it was actually like, you know, storming the beach at Normandy and all of that. And as a kid growing up, I knew my grandfather was in World War II, but he would never talk to me about it, which made me want to know more, because I couldn't know about it. You know, if you tell somebody you can't have something, now you want it more, like Twinkies.
Yeah.
You know, nobody cared about Twinkies until they took them off of the market. And as soon as they said, you can't have them, well, now we got to have them, right? So I saw this movie, and my grandfather had passed a few years before. And I called my grandmother and I said, look, Saving Private Ryan is on cable. You may not want to watch it. She was a German citizen growing up in World War II. And I said, it may be very difficult for you to watch. So I wanted to warn you. And she goes, oh, that reminds me, I have something to send you. So a few days later, I get this letter in the mail from her, and there's a newspaper article, and there's a picture of some soldiers, and the caption is soldiers as they're getting ready to board the boats to invade Normandy. And smack in the middle of that picture was my grandfather.
Holy
and in
crap.
That moment, I knew why he would never talk to me. I mean, how do you live through something like this and then just go, well, I guess I got to go get a job now and feed my family and, you know, go back to school or whatever it's going to be. How do you just see that and live that and then just go back to life?
Yeah, that's a very deep philosophical question, because you're right. It's something like that is inevitably going to change you. And as we get deeper into the song, themes like that are even going to come up here, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but yeah, just the sheer horror of what you live through, it sticks with you. And this song has a somber tone to it, which really lets the lyrics and the vocals sit with you.
Totally does.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think this would be a great time for us to hear a little more about the song.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. All right. We got through the bit where it transitions from dying to meet you into hero. Is that right, Hattie? Mm-hmm. And I know.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. On some reissues, it's just labeled as dying to meet you. But it is kind of one of those long tracks that combines two songs into a suite. And I'm sure everyone has heard those before. You got your The Hellion / Electric Eye. You got your Holy Wars, The Punishment Due, and so on and so forth. But anyway, so the song definitely takes a shift at that point. So Scott, how are you feeling about this? Did you see that coming when they took the song up tempo a little bit?
Well, I was expecting a change only because we have a change in title. So I was expecting something dramatic or drastic coming. Wasn't expecting that. And also, I'll have to add the world's longest pause in between transitions there. That was like almost interminable.
But it was a little jarring, wasn't it?
It was. But as we, and it reminded me again of those A-track days we were talking about. But as the first section was fading out, like that really had a almost like a War Pigs feel to me, you know, or I should say, what was that Electric Funeral going into War Pigs? It really had just that drawn out, slow, patient kind of music that just adds such a sense of drama, especially if you know something's coming. And the more it's drawn out, the more you're like, what? What is it going to? You're just sitting closer and closer to the edge of your seat until you fall on the floor and hurt your ass. But I really did like the transition. I like the sound. This is, though, getting to the point where you have to accept the time frame that this was recorded in. Because if Priest were to do this song now, it would be so heavy, so huge sounding. But what we have here in this time, even as aggressive as musically it is, you have a very thin recording sound. It just has that mellow sheen to it, no matter what you're doing. It just has like, almost like you're listening through cellophane.
A good way to describe it. Yeah. Of course, it's the sort of standard production values of 1974. And and there wasn't really any bands out there that were heavier than this. I mean, there was Sabbath, but if you go back and you listen to War Pigs, it's sort of in the same sonic wheelhouse as this stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you want to make the comparison, I mean, I guess arguably one of the heaviest albums of the era would be Deep Purple's Machine Head. And even with songs like Space Truckin', Highway Star, I've always felt that that album has that same mellow sound to it. You know, yes, the guitars are heavy, that you got the distorted keyboard and everything, but the overall sound of the album still has a mellow feel. And I guess I'm more, even in the 80s, I was more getting accustomed to the sound even Priest had then, more clarity in the distortion, that chunkier, heavier sound, bass being pushed through the mix a little bit more, because the bass is a little bit in the background here. I think that would drive it more, but I have to separate the production from the performance, and the performance that we're getting here is absolutely stellar from everybody.
Yep. It makes sense. Like, I guess technologically things were not there where it is now, because that was just the beginning of semiconductor era. Like, that's different. People were still using, I guess, valve technology. So that kind of added up. Like now you have like more concise machines to record and stuff. Things are easier to find and cheaper and all that and more precise.
Yeah, but ironically, what happens in the music world is we've gone from all the hassles of analog, like you were mentioning earlier about how it was produced, thinking about splicing, you know, the band records on this tape. They spent a few hundred dollars recording that song during that time, or thousands, and somebody's going to take a razor blade to it and put and splice it like that. Just, I've done it. It's such a stressful thing. But we progress and we get away from those things, and we've gotten more digital. And now, because we're nostalgic for the sound, we've now recreated things in the digital world to bring us back to this analog quality. It's like, no matter what we have, we always want what we had before.
These lyrics, they feel like they're ratcheting up the intensity a little bit as Halford is starting to spit out those words real quick in this new section of the song. killer, killer. You keep your thoughts at bay, maiming, destroying every single day. So now there's more of a third person narration. He's sort of looking at someone else, but maybe he could be looking at himself. Maybe it could be an introspection, but whether it's from the outside or the inside, this is a description of the soldier at work in battle, off to do his job. And his job is killing everyone else on the opposing side, of course.
I was just going to say that line, killer, killer, keep your thoughts at bay. I think that really kind of explains what I was questioning earlier, where like, how can you want to hurt people you don't even know? Like, you have to disconnect yourself from the humanity of it. To, you can't look at them as people. You have to look at them almost as animals or obstacles, maybe not even a living thing. And I don't want to understand what it would take to have to be able to do that. I mean, if somebody's coming at you, like when I've been attacked at work before. And so I know like defense mechanism is one thing, but to run at it on your own and say, I have to take all these obstacles out of my way, I don't want to know the mentality it takes to be able to do that. I hope I never have to experience that in my life.
Like choosing to offend first instead of like defending yourself.
Off right. Every defense.
Yeah.
In the military, there's a lot of indoctrination from leadership. They really want to instill a certain attitude where the soldiers are good and right, and they're doing their duty. They want their side to feel self-justified and that it's not really wrong to go out and kill the other side because the people on the other side, they're radicals or rebels or they're less human, whatever the excuse of the day is.
But when it's over and you come back home, you have to shut that off and just be a normal person and not attack obstacles. And you know, you have to be human again. We're not going to really teach you how to do that. Just do it.
Yeah. And there's even something in this verse that alludes to that at the very end. But you wouldn't lay a finger on your mother. Oh, no, you'll never, ever dream to hurt her. So how can you make that sort of dichotomy in yourself where you're a killer and you can go out and shoot your enemy, but you come home and the people who you know and love, you would never dream of doing something like that to them.
Exactly.
You know, I always like to get political, like this verse that now I'm just discussing with you guys, two American people. I can't help but think of Vietnam War. Like, you know, it kind of matches that timeline, like in 70s and like, you know, the way in the heat of the midday sun, like around that area and all that, and the kind of offense and violence we are seeing here. It kind of reminds us of that, what happened that later we got to know in Vietnam, like that kind of thing that happened. And they dehumanized the Vietnamese people for the U.S. Army and other people too, like just so they don't take them as humans and tag them for whatnot. And the next verse kind of validates that. Mm-hmm. When we'll get there, we'll possibly know. So I guess if, like, what do you think, George?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I'm pretty eager to get to the next part. Let's hear it.
Thank you.
Well, Scott, they really got down to that point, how you come home and you're left dealing with everything that you had to do. Mm-hmm. This song ends with, sit back and lick your wounds, because you won't go to hell. Take your medal, wear it now with pride. Consolation for the pain and sin you feel inside. And to me, that's just saying the leadership giving the soldier the whole spiel before they go home. You were right. Mm-hmm. You did good things. You're one of the good guys and you're on the right side. No, don't feel any guilt over any of that stuff. Don't think about it. Here's your medal. You're a hero.
Yeah.
It's almost kind of
in holy water.
Mm-hmm, patting them on the back and going, they're there.
Pretty much.
Because they take no responsibility for the aftermath of the war. It's just, you got to go home and it's your problem now. You know, I have to admit, I didn't like the second half as much as I liked the first half, more so because of the subject matter. I think that the emotion of it is more intense lyrically in the second half, but it gets lost in almost jovial music. You know, you've got the galloping guitar riff, which I love a good galloping guitar riff, and this one's fantastic. But you've got that little trill at the end, just that da da da. And then when you're playing the solo over it, it's kind of cutting into the solo a little bit. So you're not really hearing the solo in full, because that's kind of just like edging in. But I think the lyrics are delivered too quickly and without that same intensity. He's almost singing too casually for me to really get the emotion of what he's saying. And I think it's a bit lost for me because of that. If I take that aside and just listen to it musically, I think it's really cool. I think there's a really great bass part in the second half. I love that. I love, like I said, the galloping guitar line. Drums are solid. But yeah, and I love Rob's voice during the section. I just think the message is getting a little bit lost with the jovial spirit of the second half.
Yeah, with the groove kind of mars the somberness or what happened in their first part.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, kind of does make sense now that you mention it, but yeah.
It's somber in the first half. Take. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then in the second part, I would say it's very much not somber.
It's groovy and, you know, upbeat.
There's a lot of groove on that riff that closes the song out that you hear all throughout the second half.
But he's also not really hitting words with emphasis. He's singing very straightforward and quickly, you know, because there's only so much space for the longer lines, but he's not emphasizing any words that drive points home. So that's why it feels more casual to me, almost like, hey, you guys, I was sitting at a campfire the other night, somebody brought marshmallows and we didn't have any chocolate. Like it just doesn't hit because there's nothing important. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying, because in this show, we talk a lot about Halford's unique delivery, where he'll put a spin on a certain word and that it makes it stick in your memory more. It emphasizes a certain word, you know, a song like Metal Gods, where he sings, "We've taken too much for granted." Something like that is an example that I go back to a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not doing that here. And maybe that's just a reflection of him not being as much of an experienced vocalist yet. And he was in, like, I don't know, some very small bands before Judas Priest, but basically he was just being newly discovered at this point, and he hadn't been singing for that long.
Yeah. And now he's walking in replacing somebody. So now, you know, that we're under time pressures to get things done. He's also walking into a situation where these guys are signed. This is an album that's going to be coming out. It's going to be mass produced. That's a lot of pressure to walk into on top of everything else. So I don't want to be mean and say he did a bad job or anything like that. I can only judge the song as I'm hearing it, but I do want to take those things into consideration and be fair. Like, he's walking into kind of a high pressure situation going, all right, you got to learn these songs, figure them out, get them recorded. Let's go.
Yeah, you're totally right.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of impressive that the songs on Rockarola, some of them came out as good as they did. And just for context, Scott, this album, it was not a hit, like not even in the slightest. I mean, we've talked a little bit about how it's not too representative of the band that priest would become in later years, and they were still kind of figuring out where they wanted to go. They were also on a pretty unsupportive record label that didn't manage them well, and this album only sold a couple thousand copies. And wow, this is in the 70s when albums actually sold, so that would be like selling, I don't know, 20 copies today.
Yeah. Did they have the same label on their second album, or did they get dropped?
First two albums had this unsupportive label, Gull Records. And
I never even heard of them. There were so many fly-by-night record companies, though, because once the late 60s, early 70s turned into what would become hard rock and people saw success, oh, let's start a label. And they had no idea how to produce bands, how to support them. Hundreds of labels just came and went during that time. So it's not too surprising. I'm glad that they didn't just give up and say, well, I hate this business, or let it get to them. They endured, and I'm glad they did, because the little bit of stuff I know from them in the, you know, more recent years, I've liked. I really have. And I know that they're a hugely popular band and inspiration for a lot of other bands. So I'm kudos to them for sticking through the difficult early years.
And me personally, as someone who came to Priest, obviously in hindsight, I wasn't around when they started. And the first few albums I listened to were from the 80s. And when I found Rockarola, in hindsight, it sounded very archaic, very weird to me. And a lot of these songs I didn't like. And this is one song where I would say I never really thought about it much at all, but I have a much deeper appreciation for it now after talking to you two, because we're really digging in and breaking it down. And with a song that has this sort of depth lyrically and range, peaks and valleys musically, it's not the sort of thing that you can really take in as background listening.
Yeah, especially with subject matter like this. And you probably didn't realize this, George, but when you pick this song, Uriah Heep has a few really intense war-oriented songs that I think are some of their best work. And so you hit the nail on the head musically, but also from a subject matter standpoint. So great pick for a comparison to Heep.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. I had a feeling this was going to be something that you would enjoy talking about, and hey, maybe even a launch pad to check out more Priest songs for you.
Oh, for sure. I definitely will. Yeah. I mean, as much as I said, I didn't enjoy the second half as much. I don't want to be, I don't want to sound like I didn't like it, because I did. I just liked the first half better because it had that emotional connection, and then it kind of threw it away in the second half. But like I said, musically, it's fantastic. I really like, Rob's voice too here, because it's not what I expected him to sound like. I was expecting that more hard-edged, you know, fist in the air kind of feel that I get from the stuff that I do know from them. So I like seeing a little bit of the youth as well.
Yeah, early Priest albums, Rob is, it's kind of different than the later stuff. Like, as things happen, he was in his 20s and then 30s and 40s. Things change, but it is
living
interesting.
Living that rock star life.
Oh, yeah. But Steven Tyler was the same way. I mean, when you listen to the earliest Aerosmith album, he sounds completely different than he does on Toys in the Attic, because he had he sounded like he thought people would want to hear him sound, and then went, all right, screw that, you know, and developed his style. So it's not surprising that bands, you know, even in this day, especially in their first couple of albums, you kind of expect them to maybe be a little bit different before they really pick a direction. Because also think about what was going on at this time. Music was changing, and any band, even an existing band, had difficulty trying to figure out who they were as the overall sound of music was growing in different directions that had never been heard of before. So it's certainly understandable that it would have been a little bit difficult to go, who the hell are we at this point? And where do we fit in the industry?
Right. We've talked about metal being a genre that wasn't even really born or named yet when Priest was first getting started. But zoom out even further, the genre of rock was still itself pretty new. I mean, when is the beginning of rock considered late 50s to early 60s? And so 1974 is really not very far away from that. So not only was metal new, rock was pretty new as well.
And it was so different. I mean, you think about, I guess, what they call the fathers of or grandfathers of rock and roll, like Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley. I mean, it's how would you get this from that? You know, if that was the inspiration. I really think the Beatles were the first ones to kind of cross over with songs like Helter Skelter. Then they got weird with Revolution Number 9 and songs like that. But if you take a song like Helter Skelter, I really think that was the first song that I can think of where current rock and roll was shaped.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head with that one too. Hey, yes. That's why we brought you on, Scott. You really know your stuff.
Well, I just make stuff up as I go, but thank you.
That's also very insightful.
Thank you. I just see things the way I see them. It's like when I'm reviewing a song on the Musicians Podcast, and you know, it's a song I've never heard before or a song I'm very familiar with, I can only say, here's what this song is making me feel. Here's what I'm hearing in the moment. Here's what it's drawing from my brain, which is unique to me because no one else has had my exact exposure and experiences and influences. So there really is no right or wrong. There's just opinion. And for me, it's a matter of what I find in the song that's the most important thing. I find a lot of stuff in this song. I find a very passionate lyric. I don't know if when Rob was brought in, do you know, were the lyrics already written and he just came in and sang them, or was he part of the writing process?
Yeah, so Halford has writing credits on most, but not all of the songs on this album. So this one he did write.
So I wonder if he just came in and rewrote lyrics that already existed and just said, okay, play me the song and I'll write a story. You know, and because I'm in the band now and it's...
Yeah, that's entirely possible. You know? And because these songs go back so far and the origins can be a little muddy, there's not really any live footage from this era because it's so old that no one thought to film it. Okay, well, in conclusion, Dying to Meet You / Hero Hero, good song. And it's not one of my favorites, but it's pretty unique, and I think we found some good stuff to like in this one, although we did have some fair criticisms of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I like this song a lot, but yeah, I understand why and where the criticism comes from, and it sounds and feels valid to me as well. So yes, I think like we had quite an insightful discussion about this song. So what do you say, Scott? What's your take?
I think it's a good song. I would really like to see the band redo it with their sound now and see what they can pull out of it, because I think there's a lot to work with here. Do they do this one live at all? Do you know?
No, they don't. They haven't played it since the very early days. And the same goes for, I would say, most of this album. It's been played very seldomly after the band got onto their second album and started changing their sound, morphing into something heavier.
Yeah, I think they could do something really good with it now. But this is, you know, this is a lot of youth, a lot of, you know, oh my God, we've got a label and producers are telling us what to do. So judging the song just by the song itself, I would say it's an enjoyable song. I think it's dealing with a very difficult topic, but the lyrics are really good. And Rob is really, really showing what he can do on this song. And I like that.
Yeah. Like a young man, like making his big break, and he's like giving as much as he thought he had back then. Like just a person who's younger than three of us.
Right.
Agreed. Scott, do you have any other plugs? I know we talked about your shows at the beginning. Anything else you want to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, sure. The hub for everything I do is on my website, scotthaskin.com. You can find my music there. I do everything from relaxation music under the name of Mental Sauna to horror music. I have three albums out in my Haunted Holidays series where I ruin every Christmas story you've ever heard. And, you know, got to have that contrast. And then there's a link to my author page on Amazon where I have seven books out currently. I'll have a couple out, a couple more out here pretty soon. But yeah, that's probably the best place to get the most recent shenanigans.
There you go. Scott is prolific. And we can't thank you enough for coming and joining us and giving us all your knowledge and trying out something new with a Judas Priest song that you've never heard. And hey, maybe even a song that a lot of our listeners haven't heard, because again, this is not a super popular album. And we've been doing a few of these gems lately. And I would say that we dug up another one that's pretty good.
Yes. And I'd like to say this, like, you know, it's a message from a friend. So I was like discussing like how I'm going to have this pod episode recorded. And I was talking about you, Scott, and he was saying that you are some kind of person he wants to be like within like next 20 years. So I think you are a very inspirational person to a lot of us. So thank you so much for like joining us today.
Oh, that means so much. You know, if we're not doing things to inspire others, then I think we're really missing the boat. That really means a lot to me. Thank you. And thank you guys for having me. Thank you for hanging in there with the technical issues that are really bizarrely happening to me today for some reason. You know, I've done over 700 and some podcasts, and this is the first time this has happened. So thank you guys very much.
You're welcome. And next time we get you back in here, we'll do something from a different album and you'll get some of that diversity that Judas Priest has had over the years, just like Uriah Heep has had.
I'm looking forward to it already.
We are too.
Thank you.
That's all heavy metal chatter we have got for this episode of Judas Priest Cast. So until next time,
keep defending the faith.